forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny for the morning, cloudy and mild for the afternoon, a high of 49. Tonight, cloudy and rainy, some patchy fog, a low of 37. And a heads up about tomorrow. At this point, it looks like it could be a little messy. Cloudy and breezy, fog until late in the afternoon. We'll likely see a rain-snow mix on Thursday morning, then light snow Thursday afternoon. Current estimates of snowfall, 1 to 3 inches. Tomorrow's high, 39. Right now, sun is shining, 47 degrees Kenosha, 46 in Racine, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for WGTD in the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD on the 28th of February, the last day of Black History Month. I'm Gregory Berg. We are replaying a very special Morning Show interview from the Morning Show archives this morning. I've just finished reading an amazing book called The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. This is perhaps the single most underreported story of the 20th century. That is the contention of Isabel Wilkerson, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, and she is responsible for this book, which examines the migration of African Americans from the South to the North, a migration which occurred over the course of many decades, beginning around the First World War, and really not ending in a significant fashion until the early 1970s. And it's partly because it occurred over such a grand expanse of time, and on the other hand, in great numbers, but individual by individual. It just by its very nature then became a story, in a sense, easily missed by, for instance, mainstream media. And somehow we are only now awakening to the full significance of this migration and coming to understand just what motivated so many Black Southerners to leave all that they knew behind and set out for parts unknown in pursuit of what they thought would be more promising and satisfying lives. This is the story of what motivated them to undertake such migration, and also about what the reality of that migration ultimately was. As we approach this question, not only on its grand epic scale, but also on a very personal level, as we meet three African Americans who undertook this migration, settling in different parts of the North and experiencing their new lives in very different ways. Again, I want to laud the author of this book, Isabel Wilkerson, who won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing back in 1994 as Chicago Bureau Chief of the New York Times. And she is responsible for this incredible book published by Random House. Isabel Wilkerson, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Great to be here.
Tell our listeners, first of all, how this story, this topic, folds into your own personal life and background.
Well, I, like the majority of African Americans from the entire arc of the North, from Washington and New York to Cleveland and Detroit, Chicago, and then over to the West Coast, like the majority of African Americans that you will ever meet in the North and the West, I, too, am a product of this great migration. It is just that massive. And my mother migrated from Rome, Georgia, to Washington, D.C. My father migrated from Southern Virginia to Washington, D.C., where they met. They would otherwise never have met, and I would not have existed, not in the current form anyway, and which is a typically kind of classic American story, because most Americans can trace their roots to someone long ago who came from some different part of the world, from Ireland, and an Irish great grandmother who met a man who was from Italy, and they met in Manhattan or in Boston or Chicago, and there you have a whole new lineage born in the new world. And in some ways, that is exactly what happened to African Americans, except this happened within the borders of their own country.
Hmm. You tell us in the acknowledgments that this book is essentially three projects rolled into one, and it leaves us with even greater admiration for what you have managed to accomplish in this book. Explain to our listeners the three projects which are tied up in this single book, The Warmth of Other Suns.
Well, one of them is that I had to set out with great urgency to do the research on this book, because the migration began during World War I, as you stated, and ended in the 1970s. So in order to find people who had actually made the decision to leave, not the children in the back seat, there are many of them, but the still alive, but the people who actually made the decision to leave, because I wanted to understand what were the circumstances they were leaving, how they make the decision to leave, how they decide to go to this city versus that city. I wanted to truly understand how they got to where they were and what they'd been through, what their journey was. So I set out to interview many, many people. I went to senior centers, I went to AARP meetings, I went to churches in Harlem or in Brooklyn, where everyone was from South Carolina, and I went about this journey, which became in some ways a casting call, an audition, to find the three main characters for the book. That was one part of it, and this was all toward the effort of telling the stories, hearing the stories, and then telling the stories of these three of three protagonists who would each represent the three main streams of this migration, the one up the East Coast, which would be from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, all the way up to Washington, Philadelphia, New York, and then the one in the Midwest or the Central stream, which would have taken people from Mississippi, Arkansas, parts of Alabama and Tennessee to Chicago, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Detroit, the entire Midwest. And then the final stream from Texas and Louisiana to California, and essentially the entire West Coast. So that was one whole part of the research. One whole part was just trying to get to listen to the stories, hear those stories, and then narrow it down to these three people who would represent these three migration streams. Each of them also represent three different decades of this migration stream, because it went on for so long. I ended up with a man who had left Florida. He'd gone to school, but the money ran out. He could not go to college in the county where he was born, because they did not permit African Americans to go to the public colleges there at that time. So he had to return to picking fruit, which was the thing that people did in that part of the world, part of the country. And he found that the conditions were so difficult and the pay was even worse that he began to try to negotiate for better wages. They were being paid nickels on the box when they had to go into 40-foot trees in order to extract the fruit from it. It was very dangerous. People would fall from the trees and break a limb. So it was very dangerous, and the pay was worse. And he found himself in a situation where he was trying to negotiate for better wages, but that was not permitted in those days, in the 1940s. And so he had to flee for his life. Literally flee for his life, and he headed to Harlem, not to return to that county for many decades until he felt it was safe. And he represents the East Coast stream. There is also the Midwest stream, which is represented by a woman named Ida Mae Gladney, who migrated from Chickasaw County, Mississippi, to Milwaukee in 1937. She had been a sharecropper's wife who was terrible at picking cotton, just awful at picking cotton. And she and her family had to leave felt they needed to leave because a cousin had been wrongfully accused of a theft he had not committed. The thing that they thought he had stolen turned up the next day, but the planters had already by that time beaten him to within an inch of his life, and the family decided that they needed to go. So they headed to Milwaukee, which was a part of the migration stream for that part of Mississippi. Each part of the South had a particular part of the North they were connected to. And so she was connected to Milwaukee and to Beloit, Wisconsin, which is where she had a relative who was already there, and that's where they went. They ultimately settled in Chicago. And then the final migration stream is that going out to the West Coast from primarily Texas and Louisiana. And they ended up, people there ended up going to Los Angeles, to Oakland, to Seattle. And this was the case of a man who was a surgeon. He'd been a surgeon in the Korean War. He got out of the Army, and it turned out that he could not practice surgery in his own hometown. So he set out on a course for California, which to him was the American dream, a way out of the caste system that ruled the lives of African Americans at that time. And he found that he faced a perilous journey to get out to get through the desert, through the mountains, where he found that even far past what you would think would be the boundaries of Jim Crow, it turned out that he still could not find a place that would allow him to rent a motel room for the night. So he had to drive all this way on his own. And I ended up recreating that journey myself. I had my parents with me, and we came to these hairpin turns. It was the middle of the night. It was dark. There are no settlements for miles and miles and miles. There are no gas stations. There's no place to rest. And I began to veer from the road, and my parents, who were in the car with me and who had lived through this process of having to drive during the Jim Crow years and not being able to stop, said, we must stop the car. It's no longer 1953. If you won't stop the car, at least let us out. And so we stopped. We had no trouble at all. We made it only as far as Yuma, Arizona. I felt very discouraged by that, that I was not able to recreate it to the letter, because he had not had that option in the time he was going.
He had driven essentially straight through.
These were all parts of the efforts to create this book.
Hmm. Say a word about how you set about finding some of these first-generation participants in the Great Migration. This in and of itself was quite a challenge, of course. Where does one look when you're trying to find somebody who can share firsthand accounts of the first wave of the Great Migration?
Exactly. The emphasis is on firsthand accounts. And to find people in the firsthand accounts, again, I went with great urgency because the people were getting up in years. You know, they were in their 70s and 80s by the time I found them. And I had to I went all over the place in each of these, the three main receiving cities. And also I went to Chicago, Milwaukee. I went to Oakland and Los Angeles. I went to New York primarily to interview people. And I would go to senior centers, and I would go to AARP meetings, and I would go to quilting clubs, and I went to churches in Harlem or Brooklyn where everyone was from South Carolina. I went to Catholic Mass in Los Angeles, where many of the people had come from Louisiana initially, and they were thus Catholic. So I went to all these different places. I had a booth at the Juneteenth Club in Los Angeles. I went everywhere that I could find that I thought there would be seniors of this era who would have been migrants. And when I would go into a room, almost everybody was from the South. It was just a fact of life that if you were to go into these senior centers, everyone would have been from the South, which just served to confirm how massive this migration was.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Isabel Wilkerson, the author of a book called The Warmth of Other Suns, which tells the epic story of America's great migration of African Americans from the South to the North over the course of many decades. I said at the top, and you say it in the book, that this is one of the great underreported stories of American history, probably the most significant underreported story of the 20th century, which is not to say that it wasn't reported at all at the time. And of course, one phase of your research for this book was to examine much of what was written about the Great Migration at the time, even as it was occurring. Tell us about the nature of much of the discussion and analysis of the Great Migration as it was happening, and in particular, some of the rather disturbing and deeply racist writing which you needed to read.
Yes, the one of the reasons why the migration was not written to the extent that it very likely deserved is that it went on for so long. It went on for so long, and that at each interval where people were looking at it, for example, during the World Wars, people were absolutely looking at it because the people were coming in droves at that time. They assumed that it was over at that point. When the war is over, then the migration will be over. But what people had not realized was, and it could not have been realized at the time, it's only in hindsight that we can now look back and say, well, of course they should have known that, but it's unfair to judge them in that way, is that they thought it would be over. And they didn't realize that the migration, once it began, had opened up untapped desires of the people to leave all along. The underpinnings of this is the fact that the people were living under a caste system in the South, a caste system that we know as Jim Crow, and this caste system determined and dictated every aspect of their life from the moment they awakened in the morning to the time they went to bed. It determined that, for example, in Birmingham, Alabama, it was against the law for a black person, against the law for a black person and a white person to play checkers together in Birmingham. It was against the law. That there were courtrooms throughout the South where there was a black Bible and a separate white Bible for people to swear to tell the truth on, so that a black person taking the stand, they were touching one Bible, but when a white person took the stand, they would be touching an altogether different Bible, so that the black person would not be touching the same Bible as the white person. Someone had to go to great lengths to think of every way possible to establish and to enforce a caste system that would keep blacks and whites separate in every sphere of life. And this is something they had to labor under and live with every day of their lives. It was enforced violently through the fact that every 4 days somewhere in the South, a black person was lynched during the decades leading up to the migration, and the 2 decades after the migration, someone was lynched every 4 days, because this a caste system of this kind is in some ways going against the human desire for something better, and it was necessary in order to maintain this caste system in order to do that. This is the world that they were leaving.
And I
wanted to make sure I answered your question.
Right. I want you to say something about how and when these Jim Crow laws came in effect. You say at one point it was towards the end of the 19th century that some of this started to turn very ominous. You say it was around the turn of the 20th century that Southern state legislatures began devising with inventiveness and precision laws that would regulate every aspect of black people's lives, solidify the Southern caste system, and prohibit even the most casual and incidental contact between the races. How is it that these Jim Crow laws came into being when they did?
The Jim Crow laws came into being after Plessy versus Ferguson, but essentially that was what that was where the Supreme Court ruled that separate but equal was legal, and this was that opened up the way for all kinds of things. There were really no limits. It was just the imagination of the Southern legislatures that was the only limit to what could be deemed as a way to keep the races separate. This is something that actually hurt blacks and whites alike, because it meant that it kept people who might have otherwise been wonderful friends, as we might now all be able to take advantage of now. I mean, many of us have friends of all different backgrounds, and it's a beautiful, luxurious thing to be able to have that. But in those days, it wasn't possible. It was actually against protocol for a black person to reach out to shake the hand of a white person. There were so many arcane laws that from our perspective now, I would imagine it would be a nervous-making time to try to think of all the things that you could not do, such that people would begin to prohibit and second-guess themselves and not do anything. That meant that there was very little way for black people and white people to get to know one another. And this was all necessary in order to maintain the caste system, and the caste system was necessary to maintain the economic agrarian system, which demanded and was based upon having very, very cheap to no paid labor in order to plant and harvest the crops that were incredibly labor intensive in those days. And so they needed people to be able to pick the cotton, harvest the rice, picked the oranges and the fruit that were all that was basically the lifeblood of the South. And in order to do that, they needed to make sure that there was a surplus of workers, that the workers would readily be available, and that the workers would have no other option but to do this work. And that's why when the migration began, it began because the North began to recruit Southern labor during World War I, when immigration from Europe was cut off. And they needed to, these northern factories needed to find workers, and so they went to the South where they knew that there were the cheapest labor in the country. And when they tried to do that, the South put up all kinds of barriers to keep these people from leaving. They would arrest people on the trains once they were even in their seats. They would arrest people on the railroad platforms when they saw there were large numbers of people holding northbound tickets. And when that didn't work, they actually would wave the train on through, not permit it to stop, so that these people could not board with the tickets that they had in hand. They also put limits on the Northerners who were trying to come and recruit. They actually, in Macon, Georgia, required that they get a license in order to just try to hire a black person. Imagine that. That's beyond the realm of even reason now. I mean, no one would pay a licensing fee to go and recruit somebody at a job fair in Houston, you know, now. But at that time, Macon actually required anyone from the North who wanted to recruit someone, a black person, required that they register and pay a licensing fee of $25,000, an exorbitant fee in 1918, and something that would be, you know, astronomical even now. I mean, just unheard of. And so these were all efforts to keep the people from leaving, and yet the people found ways to leave anyway. They would leave under cover of night. They would not tell anyone, even their closest relatives, that they were leaving because they were afraid that it would get out. So they went to enormous efforts. They would leave from a town that where they might not be recognized. They had to go through great lengths to leave. And in some ways, it doesn't even sound like America as we know it now. It sounds like the Cold War. A totally different era in another part of the world, and yet this was America in the 20th century.
There's a lot of things I want to ask you about. One of them is, I think one of the surprises for me in reading your book was that often what is painted in terms of life in the South, the picture that is painted, is of a system that, of course, was terribly unjust and repressive, but at least orderly. And certainly for people who supported such a system, it would make sense for them to paint the picture in that way. That at least it was a system in which everybody knew where they were and what was permitted. There was an order to it. Not that it was a good system or a just system that should have existed, but at least it had orderliness going for it. But then when you start telling us about some of these astonishing Jim Crow laws and the wide range, it becomes actually this bewildering mess. I mean, it isn't nearly as orderly as it has sometimes been described.
One reason it wasn't orderly is that each city, each county, each jurisdiction could create its own laws. So you had to be extra careful. You actually, moving about, you had to assume that you could do nothing, essentially, because otherwise you might be butting up against a law that you didn't know about. So the assumption was that people in the South had to, African Americans had to assume an extreme affect of subservience, of being extra cautious, of not of averting one's eyes, of not even interacting at all because it was too dangerous to potentially break some protocol that you didn't know about because you were from Alabama, but you were visiting South Carolina, and you didn't know that in South Carolina, black people and white people could not walk up the same staircase. So you just were extra cautious in everything you did, which meant that they generally withdrew from interaction except all but that was necessary, which primarily meant as workers.
One thing you tell us about sort of a crucial shift is that when we come to the generations right around the turn of the 20th century, you tell us a generation came into the world unlike any other in the South. It was made up of young people with no personal recollection of slavery. They were two generations removed from it. The colored members of this generation were free, but not free, chafing under Jim Crow and resisting the studied subservience of their slave parents and grandparents. This is such an important insight, of course, completely lost to most of us thinking about this from afar, you are really talking about something very, very crucial about a generation that saw this situation very differently than their parents and grandparents did.
It shows you that that over time, each generation has to confront the challenges before them. And for this generation, we're talking about the people who in some ways are kind of the beginning of the great, what we think of as the greatest generation, the people who would ultimately have to live through depression and then go to war, World War One or World War Two, really difficult, hard times for the entire country. And on top of that, they were living in a caste system that was limiting their every step. And this generation, because they were so removed from slavery by that time, they didn't have the same sense of patience for the system that they were living under. They were not as accepting of it. And it was these people who formed that the core of those people who decided to leave. They decided to listen to the call of the North, and they decided to leave and not stay and fight. They could not stay and fight in those days. I mean, a lot of people will look at it and say, well, if they had told me to step off the sidewalk, if they told me that I could not pass a white motorist on the road, which was also the rule in the South, a black person could not pass a white motorist driving on the road, no matter how slow they were going. And the examples I'm giving you do not come from, clearly not from me, and many of them do not come from the people I interviewed. They come from actually anthropologists who went down there at the time. Much of the work that's known about Jim Crow, about the caste system, and about the migration in general comes from actually those who did anthropological work. And the anthropologists were often from Yale and Harvard, and they would spend a year or two there, and their work was essential in order to be able to recreate this. But for those people who were from this generation you described, they chafed against these rules and these laws, and they didn't see the reason for it. And they were supposed to be free. They were not slaves. Emancipation Proclamation had supposedly made everyone free, and yet they were living under these rules, which were dizzying and bewildering and dispiriting and dangerous, in fact, if one were to, by accident, do something that you weren't supposed to do. Mm. And therefore, they were the ones who were on the vanguard of this great migration, the ones who said, we, as an individual, I cannot change things, but I can leave. And that was the one thing that they decided to do. It's interesting that the people that I interviewed, and one reason why it hasn't been written about, too, is because the people themselves didn't view themselves as part of a great migration. For each of them, they viewed it as an individual decision that I made to make life better for me or for my family. That's how they viewed it, which is what many immigrants do. Immigrants don't often think of themselves as being part of I'm leaving because the other immigrants are leaving. They're leaving because there's this opportunity to leave. Things are not good where I am. I cannot bear up under the circumstances that I'm in. Something has to be better someplace else. I'm willing to take this leap of faith, and they did.
We're speaking with Isabel Wilkerson. We're talking about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. You tell us that just the trip north or west was in and of itself an often perilous experience. And even apart from all the efforts that certain Southerners made to keep this migration from occurring, they were also setting off in many respects for parts unknown. Tell us more about the nature of the journey itself. I mean, even before they would arrive in what would ultimately be their new home, what the journey itself tended to feel like for these
blacks. One of the things is that if they were driving, there were many, many places where they had to assume that they could not stop anywhere for the most part, because most mainstream establishments would not accept them at all. They could not be assured of finding a room to rest during these long drives. They could not be assured of being able to get food on the long drive. At any moment, at any place, any establishment could say, we don't serve color here, and that was a common experience. So one of the things that they did is they often carried with them these books that were called green books. They were little guidebooks for African Americans to carry with them so that, and it would have a listing of the places that, where if you were in Memphis, this place you could get a meal, you could get food here. This place would accept you to board for the night. So the entire, it would be a list of all of the places where people said they were willing to take in Black people. And this guidebook would come out on a periodic basis, would be updated. A lot of the times, by the time it came out, it was already out of date, but at least it gave them some sense of comfort to know that, you know, when I get to Houston or when I get to Charlotte or wherever they were going, this is a place where I might be able to stay. So this is part of the perils that of their journey, and the fact that they had to be reminded all along the way that even as they were leaving the place that had been a caste system that had held them down, they were defecting, seeking political asylum, even the road to political asylum had its heartbreaking reminders of the fact that they really were not wanted, many of the places they were going. And upon arrival, of course, the industries wanted them desperately, to the point that they would even bring them into strikebreakers. But the people, the workers, did not welcome them at all. Even African Americans who were there, the small number of African Americans who might have been in each of these cities already, were quite resistant and hostile to them. Whites were hostile, Blacks were hostile, because these were people who were coming up. They were people of the land, in the same way that people of the land might have been arriving from other parts of the world. Peasant people, you might say, and they were resisted, they were resented, and if the fear was that these people have just come off the land from oppressed places, they will accept any wage, and that's going to force down our wages. So a lot of this, both the caste system in the South and the resistance in the North, had to do with what is going to be the effect of having people around us who are willing to take anything in order to get a job, and willing to work long hours, hard hours, in order to do this kind of work. And this set in tone, set in place the geography of the cities as we know them, the politics of the cities as we know them, and also the lingering separation that exists in the northern cities as we know them. I mean, all of this can be traced back to the initial reaction to these people, the people of the land arriving in the South, arriving in the North from the South, seeking something better, working, trying to get jobs in the foundries or the factories, and willing to take almost anything, which was why they were such a boon to the industry, because the industry could say, well, we can get these people really cheap, very cheap, because the people were accustomed to working for nothing. They were used to working for the right to live on the land they farmed. Surely, if they were paid a dollar an hour, they would be overjoyed, and that was the case with these people. And so they met with tremendous resistance even in the North. The journey had many heartbreaking aspects to it, but the thing that was that propelled them was the fact that they no longer had to live under the arcane rules of Jim Crow and the caste system they were under. Yes, they were in a place that was hard to figure out, that was fast-paced. People didn't speak to you on the street, maybe. There were as I describe Ida May arriving in Milwaukee, you know, she was describing how there were streetcars, and there were smokestacks, there were factories, and people walking very clip-clopping fast on the sidewalk. The metabolism was totally different from everything that she had seen in the country, where they worked very hard, but they worked according to the sun. And so there was a transition that they had to make. And, you know, what's inspiring about this story of the Great Migration is that almost every single American has someone in their background, some great-grandparent, somebody who had to go through what these people went through on some level, not in the same degree, because African Americans had to do this within their own country. But you think about the great-grandparents who might have come over from Italy or from Germany or from Poland or wherever they might have come from, and they had to make the same transition. They had to leave all that they knew, mother, father, family, kin, cousins, uncles, leave the land that they had known, everything that they've known, the culture, the food, and take this great leap of faith that life might be better across the ocean, across the Rio Grande, across the Pacific. And these people had to hope that life would be better across the country in an alien land. And I have such tremendous respect for the courage of these people, and I think all of us should have a sense of respect and gratitude for the people in our own backgrounds who must have gone through this in order for us to even be here today. It also puts in perspective the strains that we often feel today, the things that stress us out. These people made this journey without GPS, without cell phones, without with cars that would the radiator would go out in a heartbeat. Just look at the radiator and overheat. And so they had so many challenges just getting out. And we, you know, a lot of us can't leave the house without having our cell phone in our pocket. So we, you know, they lived under such hardship that it's hard to imagine. And yet it puts in perspective what we have to go through today. And I think it should, you know, make all of us want to, first of all, go out and find the oldest person in our family and get the story before it's too late. And secondly, have gratitude for what they did, because we ourselves would not be here were it not for their sacrifice. And then finally is to remind ourselves that we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe. You know, all of us have some kind of a forebear who made such great sacrifice for us to be here. And I think that should help remind us of how much we have in common.
It's an important story that just has not been told enough, or the story has not been told within this particular context. We've heard a lot about, of course, the immigrant experience when we're talking about people coming here from Europe, or Hmong refugees fleeing terrible conditions there. We just haven't thought about this particular migration and these, in a sense, immigrants from our own nation in the same way. But the parallels are so striking.
Yes, the goal of the book is to pull the reader into the lives of the people that are described, the people who made this great journey, who left all that they knew for a place that they'd never seen, and left a place that had all that they had known, left mother, father, a sister, brother, all their kinfolk. They left without the assurance that they would even ever see these people again, and set off on a course where there could have been no guarantees. And the goal would be to have readers look at it and see themselves, and also see and have gratitude for the people in our own backgrounds, all of our backgrounds, who had to have made this great sacrifice to leave all that they knew, whether it was Ireland or Poland or Germany or the crossing the Rio Grande or leaving parts of Asia, wherever they came from to get here. All of us are here and owe a debt to someone who had to make the same decision that the people in this book had to make. That meant that they had to leave the only place that they'd ever known for a place that they had never seen in hopes that life would be better, but with no guarantees that it might. They had to experience incredible resistance and often hostility because they were different, often because they were from the land, they spoke with an accent. These are all part of just what happens to people who are immigrants, who are coming from one place to another. And I see so many similarities of that. The goal would be that people would be able to look at it and see themselves,
right,
and ask themselves, what would they have done? What would they have done if they were facing the same situation that the people in the book were facing, or that their forebears were facing, and to have a sense of gratitude and inspiration from what they went through?
One of the things that we learn, of course, in your book, in chapters with titles like Disillusionment, is, of course, that what greeted these immigrants, if we want to call them that, was not all that they hoped and dreamed for. And in particular, the gentleman who moves to California, who wants to be a doctor, finds such surprising resistance, such difficulty in finding patients, even from other African Americans. It's amazing how the disappointments and disillusionments can come from people and situations where we would least expect them.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of human nature that once you get to a place, you often people want to close the door on others who are coming by. and there's also a desire to distance oneself from the place that you're now putting behind you. Many people would leave and they change their names and they would melt into the new world and never be seen again. Others did not want to be reminded of the place that they had come from. Others were in such tenuous circumstances themselves that to have more people arriving by the train load day after day after day, putting more pressure on all of them, they resented that as well. So some of the greatest resistance actually came from other African Americans who were themselves just trying to get a toehold in this new world. And so he met a lot of resistance from those people. They did not, the other physicians were not necessarily welcoming to him when he first arrived. He had an extremely difficult time. Also African Americans who might have been his patients were free now, and they thought to themselves, well, we don't have to just go to this black doctor. We can go to anyone we want to. And we ourselves want to be able to go and be free and to be able to experience all that we can in the new world. And so he ran into such tremendous resistance that it was quite heartbreaking to him at one point. But as you know, is the case with immigrants in general, and of course they're not immigrants because they were American citizens, but they were forced to become immigrants in their own land. There's something about the immigrant heart that says, we must survive. We will find a way, which is so inspiring to me. They had to succeed because they could not fail. Failure is not an option for an immigrant. He had to find a way to push through that. And not only did he push through it, he became one of the most noted surgeons in Los Angeles, and he became the personal physician to Ray Charles, who actually wrote a song about him. So it's called Hide Nor Hair, and he makes reference to Dr. Foster himself in the song. The song actually did well on Billboard. But in any case, they push through because they have to. And that's also should be an inspiration to those of us who are the descendants of people who made a great leap from someplace far away in order to make life better for essentially themselves, but also more importantly for their children. And we are the beneficiaries of that, all of us. I mean, all Americans who have forebears who made a great leap of faith and made sacrifices in order to be in this country.
Another important thing we learn about in your book is what one sociologist called the Northern Paradox, and that is the fact that in many cases these African Americans were leaving behind one repressive system and entering another and facing a very different but no less dangerous kind of bigotry. At one point you write, the very things that made black life hard in the North, the very nature of Northern hostility, unwritten, mercurial, opaque, and eminently deniable, made it hard for Martin Luther King to nail down an obvious right versus wrong cause to protest. I mean, we often think about this when we study Dr. King, about the difficulty, unexpected difficulty he had in Illinois. But your book takes that on a more personal level, and we realize that for the blacks that fled the South to the North, that they had to live with this kind of hostility that was maybe not an overt kind of hostility, but a very real hostility all the same.
Yes, what was the difference between the North and the South in that time, and I would say that there may still be echoes of that even now, is that in the South, it was codified, it was law, it was written down, everybody knew the rule, and it was very clear what you could and could not do. There were so many things you couldn't do that many African Americans just withdrew to protect themselves. But in the North, there were no signs, there were no laws. There was custom, and there was the mercurial nature of you could go to one establishment, and they would seat you. You could go to another one, and they would not seat you. And there was nothing to enforce either one. I mean, it was up to whatever proprietor you might run into. And so that there was this inability to even see. The rules were unwritten and invisible, and you just never knew. They never knew when they might run into resistance, and that made it a difficult thing too, because they did not know where the hostility might be. They would always enter hoping for the best, but then they might be shocked into the reality that there was hostility in the North too. And one example of that is of George Starling, who is the protagonist in the book, who migrates from Florida to Harlem, and he goes into a bar for a drink at one day after work. He worked on the railroads, but the days were very long. They're 24-hour days. The run from Florida to New York would be that long. And at the end of the day, by Penn Station, he went to get a drink. After he'd had a drink, he had his beer with a friend, the bartender unceremoniously took the glass and smashed it against the counter for everyone in the bar to see. George Starling, who had come up from Florida, had fled for his life, really, in order to find safety in New York, found instead a mercurial, unpredictable moment in which he was reminded that in the North there were places where he was not welcome either. And that stayed with him, and he lived with that, and he found it a sad, heartbreaking thing years later when he recounted it to me.
Hmm. Ultimately, this story is, as you say, an inspiring one, for as troubling as many of the details are, and for the heartbreak that this migration also represents, the disruption of family, the breaking of ties. There is much that we can draw inspiration from as well. I wonder if we could close by having you say a word about the beautiful title of your book, The Warmth of Other Suns.
The Warmth of Other Suns comes from a beautiful passage written by Richard Wright, who was the author of Native Son and was in some ways one of the great novelists of the 20th century, and was, for our purposes here, one of the best-known people to have been part of this great migration. He left Mississippi, Natchez, Mississippi, for Chicago. He made a brief stop through Memphis on the way up, and he arrived in Chicago and became one of our best-known novelists. But as he was leaving, he reflected. In fact, much of his work dealt with his reflections on the migration and on the South and on why it had to leave. And so he wrote these words, which from which the title is drawn. And he wrote, "I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant an alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom."
Well, I certainly hope and think you should win another Pulitzer Prize for this marvelous book. Again, it is called The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, published by Random House, an important book that every American should read. Isabel Wilkerson, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this marvelous book. Best wishes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow, Thursday, on The Morning Show, I'm excited to dip into the archives and replay for you a conversation which I had with John M. Berry. And he is the author of what is widely regarded as the definitive book about the great flu pandemic of 1918. And of course, we celebrate the 100th anniversary of that terrible health disaster this year. The reason I am replaying this interview is not just because of that centennial of the flu pandemic, but also because of the fact that a flu pandemic figures prominently in the book that is this year's Big Read selection, Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. In her fascinating novel, it is a catastrophic flu pandemic that sweeps across the planet and wipes out much of the human race. And it is in part because of the 100th anniversary of the great flu pandemic that that is what she chose as the disastrous event that is at the heart of her intriguing novel. So that's why we're replaying this as part of the Big Read Project. My conversation with John M. Berry, talking about his fascinating book called The Great Influenza. Then on Friday's morning show, a brand new interview, which I am excited to share with you, an interview with the author of a new book called Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. This is a biography by Carolyn Fraser. that examines the long and eventful life of Laura Ingalls Wilder and her unlikely path towards immortality as one of the most beloved authors of the 20th century, and a writer who really helped shape America's collective idea about settlers on the prairie. That interview will air on